He lying.
He lying right there. Like,
that boy be lying.
I walked outside like, hell no. Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to Spirits and Ghost Stories. I'm your host, Thomas Ahrens.
And I'm Carly Bird.
Here we are, guys. I hope everyone had a wonderful Thanksgiving, that you were able to share it with some loved ones, and, you know, you were able to relax a little bit. Carly, how'd your Thanksgiving go?
Why do I
ask that like we were separate? We were together, guys.
I know. Carly, what did you do on your Thanksgiving? Well, you weren't there for like half of it because I was up in my office working.
She making the money.
Making money. Getting paid. And then we left in the afternoon to go visit his aunt. And she lives almost 2 hours away. So it was quite the hike to get all the way out there. But it was nice because we got there kind of early. And then we left around like 9 o'clock and still got home before, you know, midnight. And that was really fun. We had a good time with your aunt. I love going to her house because they have a farm with goats and horses and ducks and chickens and donkeys. And so every single time I go there, I always have to say hi to the little goats, give them little kisses on their heads. And but I also enjoy the company as well.
You know, the company is fantastic. And, you know, the one thing I really just, does this make me a bad person, guys? Please let me know in the comment section down below. I just don't like the chaos. Like, one reason I really like Halloween is it's a month-long celebration that I enjoy because it's kind of do things at your own pace. You get to still be outside, do outside activities, you know, corn mazes, pumpkin patches, haunted houses, hiking, bonfires. That's all in the Halloween season of fall, honestly.
You mean there's not as many group activities?
No.
You don't have to spend time with family? Is that what you're saying?
There are group activities. They're more outdoor centric,
okay.
And on Halloween and stuff. And then once Halloween happens, you know, you have so much flexibility of what you can do and who you spend time with, and it doesn't feel like a Chinese fire drill.
Yeah.
When Thanksgiving and Christmas happen, and maybe this is something when you get older and you have to split time between multiple people's houses, it almost feels like a business meeting sometimes. Where it's like
a chore. It's like an obligation. You have to be here. But that's the main reason that we set up. You know, we're with one family for Thanksgiving 1 year and then one family with Christmas, and then we flip-flop every year. That's the reason we did that, so that it can be like, you had your turn last year, don't make me feel guilty.
And that's the thing that's frustrating. Guys, yes, this is usually we start all these episodes, it's our therapy session. This is how we do it. It's way cheaper than a therapist. And then, you know, I hear the parents being, oh, well, it shouldn't be a chore to come see us. And it's like, okay, but most parents, at least the parents I've known,
yours,
you know, they never go anywhere. Everyone always goes to them. So they never had to experience the thing of like, at 4 o'clock, we got to be here. And then we got to leave, try to go here. And that's when we try to do everything in the same day. That was a nightmare.
And that's funny because, I'm sorry to cut you off, but I grew up that way. Like, everyone came to us. We didn't really go anywhere or do anything. And now all of a sudden that I'm an adult, I still have to go to my parents' house and they still get to stay home. And it's like, okay, well, I grew up and I loved the holidays because we got to stay home all day. We didn't have to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden, we have to go everywhere. And it's just, I don't know. That's what it makes me hate it.
Because you have to go everywhere?
Yeah. So I'd like to stay home and spend time with my loved ones and, you know, get cuddly on the couch.
But no, like, I agree with that. I remember for our Christmas, we used to go like to 2 to 3 different places. Mm. You know, we would go to Vicky's house, and then we would go to my grandmother's house. And then on Christmas Eve, we'd be at Beth's. Mm. So it's like you're going all these different places.
Yeah.
And I think it would have been nicer. It's like, okay, well, if it didn't feel like you're always driving and always trying to commute to go somewhere, I think it'd be a lot better. Or it's just if there are people that you haven't seen in a while. I think that's the other thing too. I think when it's like people that you always see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So example is I have a friend, Seth, whatever. If every Thanksgiving we got to go see Seth or content, whatever, mm-hmm. but you only got to see her around that time, generally speaking, it was okay. It's more of an event because, oh, these are people I haven't seen in a while.
Right. You make a day of it.
I'm making a day or a couple of days of it because a lot of people like leave town for Thanksgiving week. Yeah. You know, they're there for like 3 or 4 days.
Right.
And these are people that you only see once a year. Mm-hmm. I think it's different when it's like you're having Thanksgiving with your neighbor that you see every single day. And then it's like, is it special or just another dinner?
Right.
Like, I always thought of that, like being homeschooled sometimes, where it's like, you know, we would have an event inside. And what I mean by that was like, we'd have a little event with the group, and it's like, but it's just the same group. So it's no longer special, mm-hmm. you know?
I think the special thing that they try to make it is like, there's decorations and there's gifts, and mm-hmm. you try to play games after dinner instead of your regular, you know, everybody eats dinner and sits on the couch or whatever families usually do. I don't know what normal families do.
It's also probably because I have ADHD and I can't really sit too long.
Yeah. Tom can't. He just either passes out and then feels like it was a waste of his day, or
I've gotten better. Gotten better with that.
Yeah, but you don't want to make it feel like a waste of your day, and I get that. Or he disappears and everybody's like, "Where's Tom? Why is he so antisocial?" It's like, well, he doesn't want to sit on the couch. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope somebody else in the comment section below has that issue too. So it's not just me.
Just
so
spilling like our guts right now about the holidays. A complete
piece of shit. Yeah. So after shitting on Christmas, yeah, we're going to have a great story today, guys. This one I've been teasing for a very long time. But first, Carly, you know, what are we drinking tonight?
What are we drinking tonight? Tonight we are drinking a Christmas mojito, ladies and gentlemen. It is obviously cranberries, a little bit of cranberry juice if you want. The recipe calls for white rum, and I'm not going to lie, we went tequila all the way because it's our fave. And we went with the 1800 tequila today.
Also, it's better for you. Just spoiler, like tequila, and I think you said vodka, if I'm not, she's a fit freak. She's like, she got a six pack and everything.
I do not. I wish.
She's getting there. But the point is, like, I think you told me, like, tequila is, like, better for you. Or better in general.
Like, it's, like, lower in sugars and stuff. And if you just go straight tequila, like, yeah. That's why this drink obviously doesn't have very much cranberry juice in it. Because we were trying to cut down the calories of it. But obviously, we also have lime juice, a little bit of brown sugar. I have my zero-calorie brown sugar, and it works okay.
Actually, yeah, it's not bad.
And then the seltzer water. And then to garnish, obviously, lime wedges and fresh cranberries and a little bit of mint leaves.
So, yeah. So, guys, let's get into it. We're going to get into the Beast of Gévaudan, the history, and then we're going to tell a story about it. The Beast of Gévaudan was a monster that actually ended up being a wolf that terrorized the French countryside from 1764 to 1767. And it was a wolf attack, is what most scientists and experts believe. So, before we get into the Beast of Gévaudan, let's talk about wolf attacks. I think it was Carol Ann, good friend of ours, that talked about like wolves never bother anybody, especially in North America. And there are some facts to back up that. There have only been a few attacks on people that wolves have caused on the North American continent. There are no written records prior to the European colonization of America. The oral history of the same indigenous American tribes confirms that wolves did kill humans. Tribes living in woodlands feared wolves more than their tundra-dwelling counterparts, as they could encounter wolves suddenly and at close quarters. So, back before the settlers came, there were wolf attacks. But once the settlers came, flintlock rifles, things like that, wolves were eradicated. Wolf numbers consistently dropped across the United States as the 20th century approached. By the 1970s, there were only significant presence in Minnesota and Alaska, though in greatly reduced populations than prior to the European colonization. So as we colonized more, the wolf numbers went down. The resulting decrease in human-wolf and livestock-wolf interactions helped contribute to a view of wolves as not dangerous to humans. By the 1970s, the pro-wolf lobby aimed to change public attitudes towards wolves. I think this is very important because I think it's very interesting how the media can influence people culturally. You saw the same thing, believe it or not, with shark attacks and stuff. Shark Week starts happening after Jaws and people are like, oh, we gotta kill them all. And then there was a steady narrative like, no, they're not evil, ugly monsters. I'm not, whichever side of the fence you're on, that's fine. I'm just saying, like, there was a narrative set, and generationally it was wolves aren't dangerous and, you know, sharks don't kill people. What happens? You try to protect them. You have this lack of fear of this creature. Where was I? Towards wolves. With the phrase, there has never been a documented case of a healthy wild wolf attacking a human in North America. Guys, listen to this line. This is very important. So by the 1970s, there was a pro-wolf lobby, and it was pushed in the media, and this was their big phrase. There has never been a documented case of a healthy wild wolf attacking a human in North America. So I've heard that a ton when I was researching this, anecdotally from people like, well, yeah, but wolves have, there's no case of a wolf attacking.
A healthy wolf.
Like, that's never happened. Became a slogan for people seeking to create a more positive image of the wolf. Several non-fatal attacks, including April 26, 2000, attack on a 16-year-old boy in Icy Bay, Alaska, seriously changed the assumption that healthy wild wolves were harmless. The event was considered usually and was reported in newspapers throughout the entire United States. Following the Icy Bay incident, biologist Mark E. McNay compiled a record of wolf-human encounters in Canada and Alaska from 1915 to 2001.
Did they kill him?
Over what?
You said they attacked a 16-year-old boy. Did they kill him?
No, they didn't kill the boy.
Oh, okay.
Non-fatal.
Okay.
Of the 80 described encounters, 39 involved aggressive behavior from apparently healthy wolves and 12 from animals confirmed to be rabid. The first fatal attack in the 20th century occurred on November 8, 2005, when a young man was killed by wolves that had been habitually in the areas habited by people. That was a big word. In Points, North
inhabited
Landing.
Inhabited by people?
Yeah, so the wolf was lingering around people.
Gotcha. In
their environment.
Yeah, residential areas.
Yeah, so Point, North Landing, Saskatchewan. While on March 8, 2010, a young woman was killed while jogging near Skigan, Alaska. So in America, we have this cultural phenomenon where wolves aren't dangerous at all. However, it's a completely different tale when you go to Europe. Now, I want to add some perspective here, why I think this is. It's the wolf interaction with Europeans go back so far. You're talking all the way to the 1300s, 1200s. Okay, that's a long time where humans and wolves were interacting with each other. And this was before, if you think about it, the evolution of firearms, too. When the colonizers came over here in the 1700s, you know, flintlock rifles, muskets were getting more powerful. And guess what? Whether it's a bear, a wolf, things of that ilk, if you have, I'm going to go to an extreme to prove a point, if you have an AK-47, there's less that can really bother you. But if you go back to spears and bows, you do get lower on the food chain. So not only did we not have the same weapons to be able to protect ourselves, people were living a very rural lifestyle.
So are you saying that when people came to America, they brought guns? So that was the first interaction wolves had with human beings a lot of the time was, I mean, besides the Indians.
Yes, but the Indians didn't have firearms until we brought them over here.
Right.
And so that's what's so important, I think, to understand is if wolves dealt with humans before the modernization of firearms, they didn't have that fear of humans. Then over generations, the wolves would have that built-in fear. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, you know, if they grow up in an environment where they don't have the fear of firearms, that's genetically, I think, is given off to the offspring. And okay. Joe Rogan actually believes this point too. He says when he goes hunting, and the guys, you know, Joe Rogan podcast, check it out. This is more of a, this is not a direct quote, but the gist of what he's saying is he thinks the wolves that survived all the purges in North America, they passed on a genetic fear of humans. And that's why wolves in North America are so wary of humans in general, because they're the offspring of the wolves that survived. Because it was, any wolf is a dead wolf. Right. Well, guess what? Now you're scared of humans.
Right.
Now that could be changing as there's more interactions between wolves, but that might be the difference between North American wolves and European wolves. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so with all that said, let's get into the European back lore and then we'll kind of get into the meat of the story. There have been multiple famous, and guys, we could actually do an episode on all these wolf murders or wolf, I don't even know what you call this, just insane. One of them is Kurovov wolf attacks in Russia, which resulted in the death of 22 children and teenagers between the ages of 3 and 18.
Good grief.
In all cases, the attacks occurred in April to December period, coinciding with the wolf's cubbing season. Interesting.
Ooh.
The wolf of Ansbach, which is Germany, was a pack of man-eating wolves that attacked and killed allegedly over 300 people in the Principality of Ansbach in 1685, then a part of the Holy Roman Empire. Another one, and we'll lead with this one, which is the Wolf of Geisavang, Sweden, during a three-month period between December 30th, 1620, and March 27th of 1621. I'm sorry, 1620, my apology. The wolf attacked 31 people, which resulted in a total of 12 fatalities, most of whom were partially consumed by the wolf. So a little context that there have been tons of wolf attacks, a lot of them, which is just insane when you think about, again, but think about how long the wolf and the human have been interacting in Europe. Until the 19th century, France was host to one of the world's largest wolf populations. I didn't know that, between 10,000 and 15,000 wolves at as close to the 18th century. It had also had one of the highest rural population densities. In France, historical records compiled by rural historians indicated that during the period of 1362 to 1918, nearly 12,000 people were killed by wolves, of whom 7,000 were killed by non-rabid wolves. This is a conservative estimate, with the numbers ranging as high as 30,000 to 50,000, with over 15,000 of them being killed by non-rabid wolves. Yeah. So, point is, a lot of people have been eaten and killed by wolves between 13 and 1918. And this is something just like the shark, I think, too. It doesn't take a lot of people for it to be a threatening. What do I mean by that? Will a grizzly bear hurt a human? Yes. Do they mulch 1,000 a year? No. But all it has to do is do enough damage consistently, and then you have that innate fear of them. Because right. you know if you're in contact with them, they right. will be an issue.
Right. And you have no power over them.
Exactly. 100%. It's like the idea of like with mountain lions in California when they attack a jogger. Will they kill a human? Yeah. And we know that, so we try to avoid them the best we can, which probably limits, you know, the interactions.
Right.
Historians examined the church and administrative records from northern Italy, central Po Valley region, which includes a part of modern-day Switzerland, found 440 cases of wolf attacks between the 15th and 19th century. The 19th century records show that between 1801 and 1825, there were 112 attacks, 77 of which resulted in death. Of these cases, only five were attributed to rabid animals. In Latvia, records of rabid wolf attacks go back two centuries. At least 72 people were bitten between 1992 and 2000. Similarly, in Latvia, attacks by rabid wolves have contributed to present-day issues. However, one thing has to be known about going back this far in the database, which is anecdotal evidence. For example, an attack that happened in 1914, the only way it could be concluded if it was rabid would be if the individual died from their wounds time after, is how that was written. So it's a very interesting point there. So you can't just, what they're saying here, guys, to break down the scientific thing, you can't just say it's rabid, because back then they didn't know what rabies was. Rabies, in general, if you get bit by a rabid animal, there was no vaccine, you would die presumably 6 or 7 days later, mm-hmm. whatever. Well, what they're saying in this article is there is no way to prove a lot of times if it was rabies, because let's say you get bit and then that person for some reason died 2 or 3 weeks ago. Was it because of rabies or was it because of something else, because of germ theory? It probably could have been rabies,
right.
but that might not have been documented. The person might have just
just got an infection because they didn't exactly. wound.
They didn't have a lot of practitioners of medicine.
Right.
So this person could be bitten on the leg, go off with their normal life
right.
and drop dead. No matter what, there were tons of people that were killed and consumed by wolves, is 100%. The last piece of things before we get into today's tale is I found this thing, which is absolutely incredible. And I'm going to post a link to this in the episode description. The Wolf Threat in France from the Middle Ages to the 20th Century by Jean-Marc Macro. This is a fantastic read, and it actually has statistical data of all the alleged attacks, and they break it down between victims of predatory wolves and victims of rabies. And what's insane is from 1571 all the way until 1871, 1875 area, there, the amount of attacks are absolutely insane. And so an example is in 1596 to 1600, there were 152 confirmed victim predatory wolf attacks. Another huge incident was in 1691 to 1695, there was 262 attacks. And then the other big jump, which is absolutely insane to me, 1711 to 1715, there was 172 wolf attacks. So, because this wolf, the way it acts is pretty interesting.
Okay.
And we're going to be getting into that right now with the specific tale of the beast of Gévaudan, and how it acted and how it hunted, which was very precarious. Generally, when a wolf attacks, it tries to consume most of the body. And it would do this in a pack formation. Usually kids mm-hmm. were the ones that were attacked by wolves in general in history, or the weak dying. One reason for the uptick, they think, in attacks in Europe is because of all the wars, where you'd have, you know, swords and bows and stuff. You'd have the battlefield laced with the dead and dying, and wolves possibly gained a taste for human flesh, mm-hmm. especially when you had major wars and it was easy to find them.
That's true. Didn't think of that.
But some people think that maybe this wolf was different. It was mystical.
Oh.
Possibly a dire wolf.
Oh.
Or a lion. But we're going to get into some images of this thing here soon. So we're going to talk a little back history of the beast Gévaudan.
I think it's Gévaudan.
Gévaudan. Sorry. The number of victims differ according to the source. A 1987 study estimated there had been 610 attacks, resulting in 500 deaths, 49 injuries, and 98 of the victims were killed and were partially or completely eaten.
Ooh.
Other sources claim the animal or animals killed between 60 and 200 adults and children. So a lot of people die. The beast of Gévaudan committed the first record attack in an early summer of 1764. A young woman named Marie Jeannette Vallée, who was tending cattle in the... that is such small font, guys. I'm sorry, let me zoom that in a little bit. I'm like, is that mediocre? In the mediocre forest. In the mecure forest, not mediocre forest. That'd be funny.
Mediocre. Yeah.
Go tend to your cattle in that mediocre forest over there. In the town of Langonel, eastern of Gévaudan.
Gévaudan.
I would like to apologize to everyone in Europe. Everything I'm going to read is French.
Everything he's going to read is pronounced incorrectly.
Very hard.
Everything. Pretty much 99.999%.
One day, Marie Jeannette Vallée saw the beast. A wolf-like, yet not a wolf-like, creature came at her. However, bulls in the herd charged the beast, keeping it at bay. They then drove it off after it attacked a second time. Shortly after this official victim of the beast was recorded, a 14-year-old boy named Javin Bolette was killed near the village of Lys Habakus near Langano. Throughout the remainder of 1764, more attacks were reported across the region. Very soon, terror gripped the populace because the beast was repeatedly preying on lone men, women, and children, which is very suspicious for creatures like this, who generally would target women and children. Reports noted the beast seemed only to target victims' head and neck regions, specifically, decapitating the victim and leaving most of them partially eaten and disemboweled.
Jeez.
By the late December 1764, rumors had begun circulating that there might be a pair of animals behind the killings. This was because there had been such a high number of attacks in such a short period of time, and because many of the attacks appeared to have occurred or were reported near simultaneously. So people were dying simultaneously in multiple places at once, which was very odd. Some contemporary accounts suggested the creature was seen with another such animal, while others report that the beast was accompanied by its young.
Now, that would make more sense.
That would make a lot more sense. But it's the thing is, back then, like, and guys, understand, like, this is not like you had like CNN and Fox News and like a person with their phone be like, oh, Jimmy's getting attacked.
Right.
The fact is, a ton of people had to get like mauled by these things before, because again, it's a king and peasants. Before the king was like, all right, listen, half of our like, populace we need is actually getting attacked. Talk about we this. Probably should figure something out here. So on January 12th, 1765, Jacques Perry and seven friends were attacked by the beast. After several attacks, they drove it away by staying grouped together. The encounter eventually came to the attention of Louis XV, who awarded the boy 300 livres, or it's money, to Profax, and another 350 livres to be shared among his companions. The king also rewarded Potex with an education at the state's expense. So he gave him a college education because Whoa. This boy was able to fend off a wolf with his friends. He then decreed that the French state would help find the killer beast. Now, what also was happening at this time was in London, the reports finally made it over there because so many people were getting attacked by these wolves over there. Great Britain, who was a rival of France, started to do tabloid journalism about this beast murdering everyone in France. Hmm. And this coincided with the story, which is hilarious because nowadays it'd be like President Joe Biden, if Russia started complaining about like shark attacks in North Carolina and to make America embarrassed or whatever.
Oh, okay.
And then Biden would be like, oh, that's not true. And then to help out. Sorry, my accents are bad. But anyway, so he was embarrassed that like, oh, I guess you're right. We can't have thousands of people getting eaten over here. They're making fun of us. So the state was like, all right, listen, we're going to do some PR. We're going to hunt this thing. So he hires the first captain, Duhamel de Klim, Clement Prince Dragon. And so that basically means is they hired Captain Duhamel and his Clement Prince Dragoons, which is basically soldiers, and his troops were soon sent to Le Gévaudan. Although extremely zealous in their efforts, non-cooperation on the part of local herders and farmers stalled Duhamel's efforts. They just would not get along. On several occasions, he almost shot the beast, but was hampered by the incompetence of his guards. I don't understand that. I just feel like you're just like smashing through the woods. Like, I don't get that.
I know.
When the villagers of Les Miseries were not present and ready at the beast cross the Turkey River. So basically, let me rephrase that sentence. They used a corning expedition where they blocked off a piece of the woods and they slowly walked in unison to try to push the thing out. In deer hunting, you basically have some people walk at one end of the woods and you push them towards the guns. They did this, but somehow the beast slipped the noose, jumping across the river like a phantom. Mm-hmm. No one knew how the beast slipped the net. They saw it and then all of a sudden it disappeared and got through the defenses without ever being shot at.
Okay.
When Louis the 15th agreed to send two professional hunters at this point, because they did such a terrible job, Jean-Charles Marc Antonio Vaux, we're going to call him Jean.
Call him Jean.
Jean and his son, Jean-Francois. So Jean 1 and Jean 2.
Jean Jr.
Jean 1 and Jean Jr. were sent in to actually help. Captain Duhamel was forced to stand down and just let these two try. Take a crack at it. So he returned to his headquarters and he was all pissed off. But then the two hunters were trying to cooperate with the locals, but they found that to be impossible because the two differed too much in their strategies on how to deal with it. So one thing they used to do is they would try to poison food and stuff, but that started to kill their wildlife and the local dogs. Mm. So they weren't too happy about these guys just dropping poison everywhere. His son believed the beast could only be shot using stealthy techniques. But they didn't want to try that. So the father and son arrived in the area in February 1776, bringing 8 bloodhounds this time because the poisoning wasn't working. And they used the bloodhounds that had been trained to hunt wolves. Over the next 4 months, the pair hunted the elusive wolf, believing that one or more of these animals was to be the beast. However, when the attacks continued, after they killed a wolf in 1965, in June 1965, the couple actually killed a wolf, but the attack still happened. And this pissed off the king still because it's like, what's going on? This is not helping. That at that point, he got the help of Francois Antonio, the lieutenant of the hunt. This individual is the lieutenant of the hunt, which is in horses. It'd be like you have the fox hunter back then. He would be like the head of the fox hunting, so to speak. So he decided to do this himself. He went solo. On September 20th and September 21st of 1765, Antonio was stalking in the woods when he came across this massive beast. He pulled the trigger and fired, and what he ended up killing was what he called a gray wolf. That was, and this is what's interesting, it was 46 inches high and 6 feet 7 inches long.
Whoa.
And weighed close to 200 pounds.
Okay.
If that is true, that is one big ass wolf.
Yeah.
That is a massive wolf.
Yeah.
The wolf, which was named Lubi Le Chase, or the Beast, was said to have been quite large for a wolf. No shit. Antonio officials stated, "We declare by the presence reported signals from our hand, we never saw a wolf this big." The animal was further identified as a culprit by attack survivors who recognized the scars on the body inflicted by victims defending themselves. However, what was interesting is the attacks kept coming. On December 2nd, two boys ages 6 and 7 were attacked and disemboweled, suggesting the beast was still alive. The beast tried to capture another group of younglings, but it was successfully fought off by the older brother. So this thing is still wreaking havoc. The killing of this creature that eventually marked the end of these attacks is credited to a local hunter named Jean Chaslet, who shot it at the slopes of Mount McLean, who called it the Mountain of Death, where so many people were taken by this thing. During the hunt organized by a local nobleman, Marquis Antoine, on June 19, 1767, were able to shoot this thing after it leaped on top of him. Mm-hmm. Apparently, he shot at the creature, he missed. The beast jumped on top of him, and one of his friends took the shot, hitting it in the head and killing it.
Oh, lucky bummy had a friend.
And by this time, the reign of the beast was over. So now let's show you guys some pictures of this bad boy. And this is where I think what's interesting here. And this is where
it's actually a wolf.
Now, yes, that's the story. So here it is. Now, this is what's so interesting about this. This is what the beast is supposedly looks like. This is the beast of Jevidon.
Look at the feet. Look at the head. Talons.
But look at the tail.
Looks now, like a lion.
That's what I'm going to get into. Here's another picture of it. Look at the tail. Okay,
that looks like a deer lion.
A deer lion, yes. Yes, it's like a not deer lion. Look at the tail there.
Yeah.
Look at the tail.
Okay.
And that's what's just so interesting about this creature is the fact that there's a lot of similarities with how it's written.
Or were all of these beasts...
That one is a lion.
Rabid. You know what I mean?
The thing was, why would it disembowel people?
Because it's...
That's what's so weird. And then kill the head. And then, okay, guys, and here's the picture of the first one that was stuffed.
They don't leave the head alive. They just kill it.
They just kill it? Yeah, that just makes no sense.
You said they kill the head.
Yes.
Okay. I'm like waiting for it to catch on.
So this right here, guys, is what the beast looks like. So with all that said, time now for the tale of the Beast of Jevidon. His blood-red eyes glowed brightly in the light that came from the back porch lamp, though he stayed hidden in the shadows right behind the reach of illumination. His fur bristled as he lowered into a lying position, his massive paws leaving long grooves in the soft dirt as they stretched out before his hunking frame. I like hunking frame for some reason. Just like
hunking frame?
Like, what a hunk. Or it's hulking. I'm going to say it's...
I don't even know what this word is, but I like it.
I make words up. He laid and watched the house, his ears perked and eyes unblinking. Above the house, the large flat silver sphere of the full moon bathed the clearing in an eerie light. The slight breeze that blew ran softly across his face, bringing the scent from the house which lay downwind of him. His tail twitched impatiently behind him, making soft rustling noises against the leaves on the ground. A soft whine, which he seemed unable to control, highlighted each breath that he took. His demeanor stiffened as he sensed movement in the house that was followed by a soft shadow passing inside of a large picture window. He turned his head, his dark eyes examining the clearing, before rising to his feet again. Slinking low, he left the shadows and ran quickly for a small patch of bushes behind 10 yards from the dwelling, his long legs and lengthy body chewing up ground quickly as he rapidly approached.
He
hung down in the ample cover of the bush because I'm getting ready to attack a person, apparently, Carl. I got to speak quietly. You know, get in the mood. Like, oh, should I be quiet?
I'm like leaning in closer to hear you.
Panting softly, he hunked down.
Honk.
I don't know why I keep doing
honk.
That. He hunkered down. He stealthily resided underneath the bush.
He be lying.
Painting softly, panting, not painting. Why would he be painting, Thomas? Jesus Christ, it's a fucking wolf. He hunkered, God damn it.
I can see this a wolf just like chilling behind the bushes with the painting, hunking down.
Do some Bob Ross shit. He hunkered down. He hunkered down in the ample cover the bush provided, panting softly in anticipation of his victim. His black lips curled in a snarl as he again saw a shadow move in the house. He sniffed loudly at the air again before raising his snout into the air and letting loose a blood-curdling howl.
Ooh.
It had the effect the beast had expected. A bright light came on in the house and the curtains covering the window parted. The woman's face peered out into the night. And he could smell the first traces of her fear in her scent as it drifted towards him. Siobhan, she called back into the room. What was that? Was that a dog? He heard the one she called Francois mumble. The guy's name was Francois. Mumbled a reply. Francois, she yelled. I'm telling you, I think something is out there. Another mumble reply. Then the woman again, well, you could get off your butt and help look, she said, sounding pissed off. because it's better than exacerbated. Watching her retreat from the window and then the appearance of another shadow that joined her for a moment before passing by her and heading towards the back of the house, the beast watched, raising on its powerful legs, his body coiled tight like a spring, trembling in anticipation. Francois unlocked and opened the back door, scowling back at his wife, Genevieve. She had taken perch back by the window, and the beast could see her pale, frightened face peering through the glass. "I don't see anything," Francois called back into the house to her, hoping against hope that would be put to an end so he could get back to his reading. She replied, using his full name, "Francois Zeline, I heard it too. Something is out there." Francois sighed and knew he wasn't going to get around it without at least checking outside. He stepped out on the back step, looking up at the moon for a moment before peering around the yard. He walked slowly down the steps, glancing back at the house and wondering how far he had to go to make Jenny happy. Yeah, this is marriage issues right here.
Wow.
I watched the man as he slowly crept towards me, and I started licking my lips, now dripping with saliva, at what he would taste like. The man's scent reached his nose, my nose, and mingled with the sweet smell of fear and taste of what that warm flesh would be like. His body shook with an effort of keeping still. "I am so excited," I kept telling myself. Every instinct I had, wanting to attack, to savage, his brain buzzing with the need to eat. Francois reached the bottom of the steps and glanced around the yard before taking another look back at the house. He started to call back to Jean that he didn't see anything when he heard a noise from the bushes. Waited till
where he be lying.
The beast waited till the man cleared the bottom of the steps and walked around the railing before he pounced. His strong body uncoiled like a gunshot and leapt free of the bush. His form, an inky black silhouette, standing at 5 feet tall at the shoulders and over 6 feet long. Against the moonlight, he seemed to be a ferocious beast as big as a bear, with teeth so white they glistened in the moon. Francois's eyes first widened in shock, then fear, as he saw what had suddenly appeared, as if by magic, right in front of him. Even though he saw it and saw it clearly thanks to the full moonlight and the glowing cast from the back porch light, his mind refused to accept what he was seeing. It looked like a beast, a wolf, a lion. Francois wasn't sure, but when it wasn't either, but what it was, the only thing his mind could relate it to was death. Its front legs thick and muscular, ending in paws that looked more like hands. Each finger tapered into the crescent point of a sharpened talon. It was slung down low on all fours, its favored red eyes fixated, unwavering on Francois. Its large head framed by massive, powerful shoulders, shouldered by black matted fur. Its wide snout opening and closing, revealing pristine white fangs. Thick strands of saliva dripped from its snout. The beast growling deeply from its chest as it drew slowly ever closer to Francois. Jenny screamed from the house and Steve joined her on the porch, making a high-pitched shrill as well. The scent of fear and urine was thick in the air now as Francois's bladder released. That's such a weird save, like Francois pissed himself. A dark stain spreading across.
Bladder released.
The beast, unable to resist anymore, howling as it leaped towards the terrified victim. The man brought up his right arm instinctively to protect himself. The beast's mammoth jaws clamped onto Francois's forearm, his monstrous teeth shredding to the bone, tearing tissue and tendon alike, severing the man's arm from his body right below the elbow in one bite. blood splattered and sprayed in large and copious amounts all over the front porch and all over the victim. Violence splashes across the beast's face and onto the surrounding lawn. Francois was in complete hysteria, a managed stump of his arm spewing blood in long rivers. He tried to turn and get back to the house, but the beast was on him again. The beast leaped onto Francois's back, digging his fangs deeply into the left shoulder and taking the man to the ground, slowly savaging him. Jenny screamed from the door, frozen in horror, as this monster was devouring her husband. She saw the beast raising its head and looked at her with burning, savory, devil eyes. She shrinked, seeing its muzzle matted in Francois's blood.
Did she shrink or did she shriek?
I think shrink away from the door.
Oh.
She shrinked away. She shrinked, seeing its muzzle matted in Francois's blood and its sharp fangs stained black red. Jenny's heart froze in terror, and though her mouth moved, no sounds came out. She spun on her heels and ran back inside with Steve, slamming the door closed behind her. The beast watched her go, snarling with one sweep of his massive paws. He jaggered claws cut deeply through Francois's neck, severing his head clearly as it rolled off like swatting a baseball. The beast leaped from his prey, circling back around the house and launching himself at the large window from where Jenny had appeared earlier. The storm glass and wood rained into the house as the beast tumbled through the window. He saw the woman on the floor kneeling with her son facing him, trying to load a musket that was by the fireplace. He let his gaze fix on her with a predatory cast, his breath coming in short, harsh tones, saliva spewing from its mouth, dripping with blood. Jenny dropped the musket on the ground, cowering in fear at the gaze of this creature. When Steve picked up the musket, aimed and fired, the thing torpedoed through the air towards him, disappearing into the black flesh. But the creature did not flinch. No impact was heard. How could he have missed it? The next day, a local farmer came by that was supposed to be helping Francois move the cattle. When he got there, he was horrified at what he saw. The decapitated body of Francois completely disemboweled, with no head to be found, or arm. Upon seeing this ghastly thing, he panicked and ran back into the neighborhood. I guess that's called village? Yeah, into the local village, and got a posse together. They came back into the house, and they found no trace of Jenny. But in the closet, there, stacked mad, was the boy, Steve, mumbling to himself about what had happened. That he shot at the creature twice. Once with no impact. The second time while it was on top of his mother. The second time at point-blank range. But it never made an impact. Was it real? No blood ever spewed from this creature's belly. And what was crazy was the fact that once it had finished with his mother, it drugged the body off to leave me alone. Why would it do that? And that was the tale of the beast of Gévaudan.
Interesting. Are there such things as black lions?
I don't know.
Because it made me think of like a black lion.
I think wolves attack next too, though. Right?
Well, yeah, but I just meant like the sheer size of it and then the way they described it. I mean, wolves do have like really big shoulders too, like big thick necks, but lions make more.
It is time for scary things in the news. Woohoo!
Convinced their home is haunted, a couple have been sleeping on the balcony for over a month. And this was posted on July 21st of 2021, so a little over a year ago. Convinced their home was haunted by a ghost, a French couple had been sleeping in a small tent installed on their balcony of their apartment for over a month. Patricia and David C. and their two children moved into an apartment in the Social Park of Simcota, of the Replonges, France, last September, built in 2016.
How are you so good with freaking words? I can't even say like lie there.
I don't
like,
know that I pronounced it correctly, but I just pronounced it.
I think it's your confidence though. Like, yes. It's like, it is this. I'm like, yeah.
Anytime you see a word that you don't know how to pronounce, you go, Replonges.
All right. He lying there.
Or he lying. I just speak with confidence. Anyway, this place was built in 2016 on land that previously accommodated an old hangar. I don't know what that is. Their new home was spacious, well-lit, and modern, but the family didn't get to enjoy it for too long. As bizarre things started happening, Patricia claims that her daughter started seeing strange things around the house soon after they moved in, and after a while, the whole family became convinced that paranormal activity was at play inside their apartment. Things got so bad that they had to install a tent on the balcony to get a peaceful night's sleep, and they've been using it for over a month. It started with black shadows. I don't know. Just listen. The couple told French newspaper Le Progrès. Then it got louder. The light would randomly go out. The TV turns on by itself. My phone just moved by itself. Literally, the TV turns on by itself. The phone freezes for no reason. The dishes make strange noises, etc. Fed up with the paranormal phenomena, the couple sought the service of a so-called magnet seer, a person who uses magnetic energy to detect spirits, who, after inspecting their apartment, told them that it was haunted by the trapped spirit of a 19th century woman who wanted them gone. And therein lies the problem. Patricia and David C. don't have the luxury of simply moving to another home because David is disabled and it's impossible for them to get a place outside the French social assistance program. On the other hand, Semcoda, the company that manages the social park, doesn't buy the paranormal explanation, claiming that there is nothing wrong with the apartment and that it had already been rented twice before without incident. Patricia and David have requested that they be provided with another unit within the social park, but for now, they have no other option than to spend their nights in the tent on their balcony, the only way to get a good night's sleep.
Did they ever try, like, sleep aids?
I don't know.
That's the thing, too, is if we ever got, like, molested by ghosts like that, she's sleeping fine.
Oh, yeah. I have no problem whatsoever.
She had cats, like, sleeping on her head one time and didn't wake up.
The ghost can, like, hang out in bed with us. I don't even care.
That, I don't think the dog and I would appreciate that. We'd be out of there.
I'd be like, hey.
Who do you think pitched that idea of, like, hon, let's just stay on the freaking balcony versus get the hell out of there?
Well, maybe they were, like, it's probably the middle of the night. Everybody's probably scared. And they probably heard noises in one room. So they went to the opposite side of the house. That was probably the balcony. That's the only way I picture it, is like them being like corralled from one room to the next by like noises and then ending up on the balcony and everybody kind of just like passing out there and being like, oh, we can sleep here. So they just set up a tent.
I just feel like that's like, I don't know. Like that's one thing when we did, and guys go back in the archives doing the haunting on, the haunting on Hill House. Amityville Horror. Where it was like, they kept saying like, no, we put too much money into this house. It's like, okay, at some point, I don't know. Like, I guess everyone's financial situation is different, but get out. Like, okay, just sell the damn place.
They can't get out. And I mean, their choice is there or homelessness. That's literally what it said.
Guys, let us know in the comment section below, how long would you last with a ghost in your house? And you know what? I'm going to put up a poll actually today on our Facebook, our YouTube page, because we can do that now. Mm-hmm. How long would you last in a house? A week, a month, 6 months?
That's a good question.
Like, how long could you last?
You do have to like explain though what the symptoms would be. Ooh. Of the haunted house. You can't be like, how long would you last in a haunted house? Because a haunted house could mean like you hear people walking up and down the hallways. Big whoop. Okay, well, what's this ghost actually doing to you to like drive you crazy?
It's got to be scary though.
Yeah, but like you have to say what's going on in the house before you can release that pole.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, I'll think about that. We'll put that pole up on the channel.
All different kinds of hauntings. I mean, what? Are they seeing, you know, people writing in the mirrors? Mm-hmm. Get out. Are you hearing screaming in the middle of the night?
Jump
Do you
scares.
See somebody standing at the edge of your bed?
That would be
like,
terrifying.
What kind of hauntings are we talking about?
Like the sleep paralysis, like demons or whatever, yeah. that like just stare at you? That would be That would be a no-go for me.
Kayla's friend.
Yeah, or Kayla's friend. Or honestly, like dealing with a cryptid. Because we did put that up on the polls. And what is interesting, I said, like, if you're camping outside, would you rather run into a cryptid or would you rather run into a ghost? And it was like 80% people were like, I would rather run into a ghost than a cryptid.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because people want a lot of ghost stories. But then the real thing is like, you don't want to actually find one of those things.
No.
Especially if it's the beast, a Givaudan. Guys, this has been week 61. I hopefully everyone had a fantastic Thanksgiving, and we'll see you next week on Spirits and Ghost Stories. Bye.